Welcome to another episode of Breakaway from the Rat Race. And today we have the pleasure of speaking with Chris Sevigny. Chris is a real estate investor, a real estate professional with over 20 years of experience. He has developed over $750 million in real estate and is well known for his honesty, integrity, professionalism, and most importantly, his passion for real estate. Since entering the real estate business, he has strived to be an industry leader with whom his partners and colleagues can put their trust and faith. And this is very important because he's working with finance, he's working with mortgage notes, and he's working with multiple teams over the years. And he has won numerous industry awards for his excellence and innovation. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric, for having me. How are you today?
Very good, very good. So tell us a little bit about kind of what you are currently doing in real estate and what mm-hmm. brought you there.
Yes. So what I'm currently doing in real estate, late last year, excited that we launched a new real estate fund focused on mortgage notes. It's a $75 million fund, and kind of always being an entrepreneur and zigging when people are zagging, we structured it very different than most syndications or funds. What we did a little differently is we went through the SEC through their Regulation A qualification. So mm-hmm. we actually had to submit and have the SEC review all our filings for this offering. And the reason we did that was it allows us not only for accredited investors, which a typical fund only allows as a private company, but yeah. for non-accredited investors as well. So we opened up kind of the playing field to allow anybody who's looking to invest in something passively the ability to, because a lot of people are left out of being able to invest in some alternative investments, especially with what's going on in the markets today. Yeah. You know, they don't have as many options, and we wanted to give people that option.
Yeah. So this is great because this is something also that I find very interesting. So what's the minimum investment for these retail investors?
Yeah, $2,500.
So that's great. Yeah, because that's what I found is that a lot of people want to invest in real estate. They want to have mm-hmm. a foot in the door. They know the mm-hmm. how important it is, but mm-hmm. a lot of time that barrier to entry, the initial investment, if you know, is mm-hmm. huge, or you have or you have to be an accredited investor. So you've actually mm-hmm. lowered the bar significantly for, and somebody with as little as $2,500 can invest in mortgage notes.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we do have a lot of people who, you know, from the non-accredited front, there's two aspects. There's people who want to invest, you know, $3,000-$5,000, but you also have a lot of people, which, you know, I've heard the term Henry, which I enjoy, which is high earning, not rich yet, that they might be like a real estate agent or somebody else where there's, you know, they just missed that accreditation status, but they've saved up and they may have like $50,000 sitting in the bank, but they can't, you know, have the ability to invest because they could meet some of those minimums on some of those accreditation funds, but they're not considered accredited. So it opens up for, you know, and that's where I had seen the reason we went through this was I've done multiple funds over the last 5 years. And, you know, I had a lot of people basically reach out and they're like, oh, not accredited. Huh? You know, hey, I have 50,000. And I'm like, you're accredited? They're like, no. And I'm like, sorry. So that was really one of the reasons why we also wanted to focus and go through this process, which for people that understand, if you do a traditional fund, like what's called the Reg D, which is the accredited investors, you know, it might cost like $10,000-$15,000 to set up. For a fund like this, you have to add a zero to the end of it. So it's, you know, much more costly because of the number of players involved and of course the SEC component.
Yeah, and also if you're raising $75 million, that means you're also a tier two Reg A. So that means you have to have audited financial statements.
You know, actually, right before this call, I was on the phone with Grant Thornton, our auditor, just going through our audit for, you know, our 2022 books and going through that process with them, which, of course, we started that in November, you know, before the year even finished. But yeah, there's that whole auditing process as well that you have to go through.
Mm-hmm. So now let's say I have like $5,000 I want to invest. What does that investment look like? Am I investing in one specific note? Am I investing in a portfolio of loans? Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a portfolio. And the other way we structured it a little differently is we originally looked at doing it as a REIT, but because we buy distressed debt, you know, within the REIT and the tax structure of a REIT, if we modified a loan, it would could be considered an enhancement, and then we'd have to put it in a TRS. And there's a lot of things that basically allowed us, basically forced us that we couldn't do a REIT. So what we actually did is we structured as a C corporation. So from a corporate level, like we will pay the corporate tax, but our investors get a dividend. But it's also more beneficial for them because instead of them getting a K-1 and getting charged ordinary interest, I'm not a tax professional, so I can't give tax advice, but we issue 1099 dividends. And if you've held it for long, you know, over a period of time, you know, it's taxed, that should be taxed at a much lower rate. So it's also a benefit for the people who are accredited, who invest in our fund, that they're not piling on top of more additional costs on the ordinary side. It works, you know, on that dividend type side as well.
Yeah, and the dividend, I think the tax implication is lower on the dividend compared to
I think it's either 0, 15, or 20%, I believe, are the three. Three criteria. And, you know, for us, we pay the dividends monthly. Like a $5,000 investment, they get 8% issued, you know, so 8% annualized, it's annualized, but issued monthly. So they get a check every month for basically at 8%.
Oh, that's cool. Is this like an 8% preferred and then there's an upside, or is it like it's just 8% straight?
No, it's just 8%. And we do have additional percent. We do give out bonus shares for people who invest additional amounts as well. So there is the opportunity for bonus shares. Yeah. And we also are launching at the end of this month, a Regulation D offering that's alongside it as well, that has some different terms, but also higher. It's more for kind of, you know, some higher net worth individuals from that standpoint. But yeah, so that's kind of the structure. So like you mentioned, it's not just one single asset, like a syndication where you're putting all your eggs on that one asset. Yeah. You know, currently we have over 100 plus assets in our portfolio already. So yeah, it's going well.
Wow, that's very good. 8% return, you're getting that as dividends. So the tax implication is lower than if you were getting like interest percentage. Yeah. What's and you're basically buying these? Did you say they were notes in default or they were distressed notes or?
Yeah. So we probably have about 60 to 70% will buy that are defaulted, and most people think a defaulted loan might be somebody's like 3 months behind. We have loans that are 5, 6, 7 years behind, and a lot of times what people I think. Again, most people, we have to do a lot of education on this space because I didn't hear about this space till about 10 years ago. So, and I was in real estate for 15 years at that time. So we do a lot of education, but we're buying them at a discount. So let's say, and just number, people can usually visualize things with numbers. Let's say there's a house that somebody bought 10 years ago for $120,000. They put 20 grand down. So they finance $100,000 over 30 years. And I'm just going to use simple math, 6% interest, which I believe is a $600 payment on that house. Let's say today it was still $100,000 that was still owed. We'd probably pick up that loan for about 50 to 60,000. So we're paying a much lower premium. So because of that, we can then work out the borrower to say, okay, instead of making all these 20 payments you're behind, give us 5 payments. And then, you know, we're collecting $7,200 a year on mortgage payments on a, call it $50,000 investment, which is, you know, basically a, you know, rough numbers, 14%, you know, return on that investment. And it's actually more profitable for us to keep the borrowers in their home, but it's also, there's, I mean, so many positive ramifications for them to create the win-win. You know, we don't like to have to throw a family out or foreclose or, you know, have the kids change schools or anything that. So it's a win-win for both sides because it is in everyone's best interest to try and keep them there as well as on our end versus foreclosure, taking it back, trying to sell it. So it's one of the things we try and look at when we're buying these assets or who are people we think we can work with. If the borrowers, if they file bankruptcy 5 times in the past, probably not much we can do because you know, somebody's a serial bankrupt.
Yeah, so I mean, these non-performing notes, I mean, also there's often you have to kind of like do like creative, some be creative and help them out of the situation. Are you kind of like having a department or people that are specialized in that area that are working with these owners, and then say, hey, you know what, this is like, I know you're in trouble right now, let's do this, and let's you know, let's refinance, or let's do something creative to make sure you stay in the home and that you pay.
Yeah. And what I think the difference between us and kind of a bank, you know, and, you know, banks have hundreds of thousands of loans. They're not experienced in working this stuff out. And a lot of times when they default, they just get the person is always getting shifted to somebody new. You know, today they speak to Joan, tomorrow they speak to Jen, and then Friday speak to Tom. Yeah. You know, as a small firm where we can touch every single loan, you know, it's not starting out with, hey, you got to give us this much. It's, hey, what type of plan do you think you can start with? And we'll see if that's even something we can work with to try and then create a customized plan and then get creative to give it to them. So we can get deals done literally in 30 minutes with a borrower, where I know people who have had to deal with banks 15 years ago, where it took 9 to 12 months to come up with some type of plan, you know, during the crash of 2008.
Yeah. And often they don't have, you know, they don't do that. I mean, they just say it's better for them to just go in, let's just refinance, or let's just do let's just delay or tag it along to the end of the mortgage or something like that. But it's not very creative. They're not gonna go necessarily and rework the entire loan to make it happen. But it sounds like in your situation, because I'm thinking like as an investor, if I'm going to go invest in your fund, I'm going to put my $5,000 towards a bunch, towards these non-performing notes. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that you're going to either make them perform, or you're going to go and say, okay, well, I have a plan. My plan B is to do this, sell the notes out, or, you know, the last resort would be foreclosure, which is the most painful way.
Yep. And that's, you know, that's kind of usually our, you know, plan, you know, like you said, plan C/plan B.
Yeah.
You know, there's loans that, you know, we do have to take, you know, start with the legal process. And there's some people who just don't play ball with us. But a lot of times there's also, you know, a person may have, you know, passed away and there's no family. So it's not always like, hey, you know, you're going through a foreclosure, but well, we're foreclosing because somebody passed away. There's no family, there's no heirs, or there's a family that just doesn't want the house and they're just going to let it go. And they don't want to deal with signing the paperwork, or there might've been a second mortgage on it as well, which we can't just sign it over to us because we don't want to take that second mortgage. If we foreclose, it wipes that out. So there's, you know, a lot of strategy involved with that, but yeah, I mean, that's one of our main focuses, is making sure the asset in the investment, the original investment, is very secure. And again, we can't, you know, promote, you know, a lot of this stuff because of how we, you know, have to deal with the SEC, but we want to try and make sure our investment to the value of the loan is typically, or the property itself, is like 30 to 40%, because we hear that a lot today. Well, what happens if housing values fall? And we explain people, we're not originating loans today. You know, we're buying a loan from 10 years ago where the house may have been 200,000 10 years ago, but guess what? It's 300 today. Yeah. So, you know, and we have the note for 100,000. So housing would have to drop 60% for the investment. And if housing dropped 60%, there's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot more to worry about.
So what, where are you finding your notes?
Great question. A lot of the notes we find recently, when we started out in this space, we were buying a lot from other, and, you know, retail investors and smaller funds. And as we scaled, we're at a point now where the servicing companies, who are the companies that handle a lot of the outreach and payments for us, because you have to be licensed to do that, they usually have what's called a trade desk, because they may have 5,000 clients, and, you know, clients are always buying and selling. So they'll act as kind of the middleman or broker. So that's one avenue. And the other is what we'll call whole loan trading companies. So a lot of larger funds, you know, they don't have, it's not worth it for them to hire somebody just to kind of be on the sell side. Yeah. There's companies that specialize in this. It's kind of like a commercial real estate broker when you think about it. It's a broker who will basically collect all the data from them, basically send it out to a qualified list, because that's important as well. Because if you send it out to the world, you know, there's a lot of unqualified people who will throw numbers at it. So it'll kind of be behind a paywall that you have to get qualified. They'll run a background check on our company, make sure we have the financials. So that's a lot of times where we'll see product. But it's interesting too, like our fund is $75 million. And people think, oh my God, that's a lot. And when you look at housing as a $16 trillion market, distressed debt alone is about $500 billion. Yeah. So when you look at, I mean, we see, you know, just this month of January, we've probably seen $100 million of product just this month. So to give an idea of like how much, you know, is there enough volume for us to buy? You know, we're just such a little, you know, piece of pie. You're not even, we don't even show up, you know, unless you pull out a, you know, the microscope.
The bar chart, you're just a line.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are your buying criteria, your acquisition criteria for these notes?
Yeah, so our buy box is, you know, primarily like, you know, single family properties. We'll dive into like some duplexes, some small multifamily, but we stay away from typically land or any type of manufactured home. Asset value typically above 100,000. And what we'll say with that is kind of a median priced home. Yeah. And it really depends where you are. Like I'm in Northern Virginia. If there was something $100,000 here, I wouldn't touch it. But if I was in Dayton, you know, just somewhere in Ohio, you know, Ohio is much more affordable. Yeah. So if it's a middle income type property, that's really what we look for. We usually don't go super high end. Because
what's your top top price? Not price.
Top price, about $1 million. About $1 million.
$1 million? Again, oh, well, that high. Huh? Okay.
Yep. And it's really dependent too, because there's certain areas like San Diego or Santa Barbara, California, where, you know, basically I could drop my cup on the side of a road and put $1 million price tag on it. And that, you know, 4 by 4 square inches will be $1 million.
Yeah.
You know, so, the most expensive, loan we bought was about a $1.5 million property in Washington, DC. It was a beautiful row home that was part of a, company that had filed bankruptcy and had to, they basically were underwater. So we bought that loan and, sold the property. But we typically stay away from a lot of those types if it's a single family owner, because a lot of them are also professionals who have a lot of money behind them that can also spend a lot in legal fees and just drag things on. So, you know, we, you know, it's not that we won't fight, but sometimes you got to be careful who you're going in the ring against.
Yeah. So that's good. And it sounds like you're going to any market.
Yeah, we've invested in over 40 states. Yeah. And the states we haven't hit are typically states where I'm not really going to see anything anyways. You know, the Dakotas, Alaska and Hawaii, we haven't hit. And then we stayed out of a bunch of the Northeast states and Pacific Northwest because the laws in those states are really, really challenging. And you know, like Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, I'm from Massachusetts, but they're really small states, and it's also real estate's really expensive. So a lot of those loans actually banks will want to hold on to because, you know, there's a lot of value still holding some of those assets for them.
What's your due diligence process like?
It's extensive. So we analyze, you know, kind of run down two spectrums. First, we'll look at the property itself to, you know, we don't get to go inside the property because if you have a mortgage on your house, you're not going to let your mortgage lender just come knock on your door and come inside. So we send out inspection companies to actually do like a physical inspection of the property, but from the street. So they'll give us a report kind of like roof condition, exterior siding, kind of, you know, driveway, kind of what's the visual, because a lot of times you can tell, hey, look, if the roof's got a tarp on it, I can only imagine what the inside looks like. If the outside, the shrubs are trimmed, grass is cut, you know, and, you know, so forth. It's not always the case with the inside's great, but it's better chance the inside's better. So we send somebody to look at the property. The most important thing is the title side of things, where we'll run a title report to make sure we're in first position lien. Are there taxes owed on the property? Because taxes actually can jump over our lien and lose position. So that's extremely important. We have an attorney review every single file within the state it's in, because title may look clean, but there could be some obscure law that, you know, loans originated before this date or something. Perfect example is in Maine. Maine has this court case called Greenleaf, where people are familiar with MERS, which is the mortgage electronic, I think, registration system. Mm-hmm. And what happened is all the banks are pooled together in the system. And when they buy and sell loans, they can just trade them within the system. And then if it gets desecuritized and moved out, then they have to just issue the document then. Mm-hmm. But what Maine came back and said, all those little transfers you did were illegal, and you have to go back and replicate them with the actual bank.
Oh, wow.
But the issue is, from 2008 to 2012, what do you think happened to 90% of those banks?
Not in good shape.
Not in good. So, you know, there's a lot of people in Maine right now that actually can't get foreclosed upon because of this. They don't know that. So, you know, we could look at title and say, oh yeah, everything looks good. So we have an attorney also look at it because of some of these obscure. And then of course we will review all the information from prior the loan history. What are the comments, that the conversations that have been going on? What does a credit report look like? Is there a title insurance policy? Is there anything in that file that will give us, you know, cause? Is it a borrower, you know, did they file bankruptcy five times to avoid foreclosure? So, you know, we kind of call it like our, you know, our 3D approach, where we look at, you know, the property, the person, and the predicament, because those comments will usually tell us what happened to get into a default. And like I said, a lot of times it's somebody, you know, basically may have lost a loved one, temporary job loss, you know, and that happens with 65% of people living paycheck to paycheck. But then, okay, are they back on their feet is the important part.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, I mean, exactly. People, healthcare, health issues is a major
see that
factor.
A lot. And same thing with bankruptcy. Like, why did they file bankruptcy? And the interesting thing is bankruptcy is public record. So we can go in and see. And if we see somebody's got like $4 million in medical debt, you know, or something, it's like, okay, that makes sense. And, you know, it's basically they're filing because it's not they couldn't afford their payments. It's, hey, look, they didn't have insurance and now that something happened. And, you know, that's the reason why.
So. Yeah, yeah. So when you're dealing with the notes, you're not dealing with the homeowners. You're dealing with either the servicing company in most cases, or a bank. Or do you sometimes also deal with the homeowner?
Rarely will we deal directly with the homeowner. And the only time we usually do is if somehow they get our phone number and call us. Usually it's a servicer. So the servicer is a point of contact that will deal with them. And we really will manage. We manage a servicer, and then we'll manage the attorney if we have to get an attorney involved. And then of course we have a, you know, a slew of other companies. We have a company that specifically does tax searches on us, where, you know, basically we make sure the taxes are paid. And again, because you can lose to tax sale. So we pay them and they ensure us that if it's delinquent, they will notify us to make sure we get it paid. And if it gets sold and they screw up, then they insure our loan for us. So it's kind of like an insurance policy. And of course we have an insurance company, because a lot of people who are not paying on their loan also aren't paying their homeowner's insurance. So, you know, we manage, you know, a third party insurance company that we put properties on insurance as well.
Okay. Okay. So, what would you say, like if someone is, they really like the model, but they said, you know what, I'd like to be in control. I'd like to do that business, but I don't want to, I want to do it. I really like it. I'm really inspired with what you're doing. And then, you know, they want to do something like that. So what would you recommend that they do in order to get started on their own?
Yeah, like pretty much any business, you want to educate yourself on the business, get an understanding, know who the players are in the business as well. And what I mean by that, like what consultants, who you'll need. You know, it took me about 6 to 8 months of, I'll call, studying before I bought my first loan.
Yeah.
I know people have taken over, you know, years to do, which isn't a bad thing. It's just a matter of what is your background in education. I came from real estate and finance, so I picked up certain things very easy. Yeah. What I struggled with was the title side of thing. And yeah. understanding the chains of the title. So first, you know, again, the education component, and I would say understand the time commitment. And if it's something that you're thinking, hey, it's kind of a hobby that I just want to do, you're probably just better off doing something different or investing because the amount of research you're going to have to do, and then, you know, like building a calculator to figure out how to calculate your returns is very different than just owning a home and yeah. collecting rents.
Yeah.
So that alone, and all the time you'll spend to get everything set up where, okay, I can go private lend or do a performing loan and great, I'm going to get 11 or 12%, but yeah. I spent 400 hours this year doing it where I could give my money to somebody else and get 8 to 10%.
Yeah.
You know, you look at kind of in after tax and look at those numbers, you know, what'd you actually earn for $400, 400 hours is like $1 an hour or, you know, $5 an hour. But if it's something like, hey, I want to potentially make a career out of this, that's, I think, a little bit different because it is a business that I think you have to have some money and be able to scale. It's very hard to only buy two or three notes because a lot of people yeah. also, when they sell, they don't want to just sell one. They want to sell, if they got 30 to sell, they yeah. don't want to sell to 30 different people. You know, yeah. they want to sell as many to that one person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, you have to, how much knowledge do you think you need in the market, in the real estate market, mm-hmm. in that particular market?
Yeah.
you know, because for the due diligence and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You need a lot. And the other thing too is, you know, typically it's not going to be your market is where you're investing. And again, depends where you're located,
yeah.
but you know, if you're in California, you're probably not buying a lot in California because there isn't yeah. a lot, you know,
you
I'd say
a lot of money.
Yeah. I'd say 60% of our portfolio is, the Rust Belt and Southeast.
Okay.
You know, basically, you know, east of the Mississippi, kind of, you know, south, you know, Pennsylvania south is where I see a lot of assets. You will see a lot in New York, but New York also, if it's defaulted, might take you 6 years to foreclose in New York. Yeah. And do you want to spend 6 years of legal fees and paying property taxes on a property nope. in New York? You have to have some serious cash behind you.
Exactly. The other thing too is that how does the like the real estate market? I know that, you know, some places like in Phoenix and stuff like that, in mm-hmm. Austin, Texas, the yep. real estate market really took mm-hmm. a nosedive mm-hmm. In terms of value. How does that affect your business?
It's the correlation is not as it's not as high as people think. Mm-hmm. And what's more correlated with our business is actually unemployment. Because okay. when you think about it, you know, and Eric, you know, if you own your house, you know, we also buy, of course, performing loans. But if your house drops by 20%, does it affect you if you're not moving?
Yeah, no.
No.
Yeah, same thing with the rental. I mean, I keep telling you.
Yeah, same thing.
Investors.
Exactly. Right. Where, and the thing I mentioned earlier too is because we're not originating new paper today,
yeah.
we're buying loans that were originated, you know, five before COVID. Let me, yeah. that's the simple way where before it really shot up. So if yeah. we had a house that we was originated in 2014 in central Ohio, where that house may have been $100,000 then,
yeah.
And we're paying $50,000 for that note. Today, that house might be worth 150.
Yeah.
So our initial investment's 50. The house is worth 150. The house has that equity. So yeah. a 20% drop, 30% drop brings them back to where they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's where I mentioned earlier, our investment or that principal to the property value, typically in 75% of our notes is probably between 30 and 45, 50%.
Okay. Okay. Because I was thinking also like in 2008, I mean, when the mm-hmm. value went down, then people just said, oh, forget it. They were like,
they were walking away
yeah. and said, mm-hmm. you take my house and, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not paying that mortgage yeah. because they were underwater.
Yeah. I think the difference today than 2008 is today there, even though prices are going down, there's still a very big inventory crunch. And rents have shot up so much. What we're seeing in our business, which is expected, you know, and you read the news, they're saying, oh, foreclosures are low, foreclosures are all-time lows. Of course they are, because if I have a $100,000 mortgage in a $200,000 house, I'm not going to let them foreclose, because where am I going to go?
Yeah, exactly. You
know, what they're doing is they're filing bankruptcy to restructure their payments to get back on track. And we're seeing a huge uptick in bankruptcies, which again, we actually prefer, because you can, it's completely open book. You get to see every single debt that person has. Yeah. And it's another attorney who manages them to make sure they make their payments.
Yeah, that's right. Because I remember, like in California, I mean, the foreclosure, you know, you never get to foreclosure. They would send foreclosure letters and stuff like that, like 90 days prior. Mm-hmm. But then it would never get to foreclosure, because they say, well, I'm just going to sell my house. It's going to take 1 week or, you know, whatever. So they would get the market. You would never be able to go and buy the house at a discount because they know what the market is. And it's like, okay, even if they were in foreclosure, they don't care.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the major institutions learn from back then, where previously they're like, hey, look, we're just not going to modify your loan. You either got to pay, you know.
Yeah.
The joke is, you know, stay, you know, pay. But now banks have also kind of, like you mentioned, hey, let's tack it on to the end or do something, because they realize when it goes distressed, they now have to put it as a liability on their balance sheet. And, you know, people don't realize banks actually can create money where they can lend basically 10 times the amount of money you put in the bank, fractional lending. It's an interesting thing to read about if people like finance. So it actually hurts a bank to have distressed loans.
Yeah, for sure. The how about interest rates? So interest rate has been going up recently. So where do you think interest rates are heading? Does it affect your business? How does it affect your business? Because I'm thinking, let's say the interest rate goes up to 12%. And then now I've put my $5,000 at 8% with your company. Are you going to adjust the interest rate up or down as the market, the mortgage rates are going up or down? Or is this, you're always looking for in the notes for that particular return of around 14, 15%?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because it's kind of a two-pronged approach a little bit, because there's on an asset level, and then how do we treat our investors?
Yeah.
So on an asset level, you know, the loans we buy might be interest rates anywhere from 3 to 9%, which really is somewhat negligible, because we're buying it targeting on a performing loan, where we target, you know, 12 to 14. On non-performing loans, we target about 20%, little higher.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that's outside of G&A expenses and stuff, but on individual loan basis. So on the buying the assets, the interest rate aren't as, you know, big of a deal. The other part, like you mentioned, is now if interest rates go to 12% and free money from the government is at 10%, yes, then of course that would, we would look to adjust. With the SEC, the way it's written is, you know, you basically, we provide a dividend, which is, I'd say, a minimum. We can provide additional dividends, or we can increase our dividend at any period of time. And we have the ability to do that. And we know taking care of our investors is important. And if we're giving our investors a good return that's a little above other returns, then, you know, we want to keep our investors long term. We're not in this for the short term. And if, you know, I've learned over my career, you take care of your investors, they'll stick with you, because, you know, I invest too. And it's a pain in the, you know what, to go find a new investment, scout somebody, and you spend 6 months with your money sitting around doing nothing or in a low yield account. You know, you may have been better off just leaving it where you were. So yeah, that's the one thing we really focus on, is that kind of, you know, the Fed rate and the, you know, the risk-free return balance that we have to manage as well.
Yeah, okay. So the other thing you mentioned earlier is that unemployment is really the most important factor in your business. So can you tell us kind of like where do you see, you know, get your crystal ball out and then tell us where's unemployment going to be in the next 12 months, and how does it affect your business?
Yeah, I will just say this is throwing a dart blind. So I didn't answer your first question. I'll answer about the interest rates, where I think they're going. I think the Fed is going to continue to increase rates. I think it's going to be a longer period of time than people are expecting for the rates to come down. I look at the Fed and the economy more like a train where it ramped up quick, but now you kind of got to slow it down. I think it's not kind of like landing on an aircraft carrier where they have the cable and they can pull you out in a few minutes. And my wife works for an international organization and understands macroeconomics. And if a lot of the world is going through a recession, it's going to make our challenge a little more structure. Yeah. I do think interest rates probably by the end of this year, I'm guessing they're probably going to be around 5.5. I don't think.
Oh, you think the mortgage rate is going to go down, continue to go down?
I think it will go a little bit down by the end of the year. I think, maybe 5.5, 6. I don't think we're going to hit 7 or 8 again. I know, the feds will probably get to about 5.25. So, interest rates, I think, will be slightly ahead of that. If they do towards Q4, maybe drop it by a quarter point or start doing any type of easing. I think 2023 is going to be a painful year for a lot of, companies. I'm not bullish on the markets for this year.
The stock market or which markets?
Stock market. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
stock and housing. I think housing is, I would not be surprised, and I've always been a pessimist, so take this with a grain of salt. I wouldn't be surprised to see housing start getting back to 2021, maybe closer to some 2022 levels. Prior to pre-COVID, maybe a 10% bump above what it was pre-COVID. It's just unaffordable for somebody to own a house right now. I mean, basically it shot up so quick rent. And now interest rates, in rent.
That's why I do rentals.
I think
the affordability crisis is really coming because of the interest rate.
Yeah,
the interest
exactly.
rate is really affecting the affordability.
And if interest rates aren't going anywhere, there's only one other thing that can happen with housing.
Yeah.
Now on the unemployment component, I know tech is getting crushed right now on the tech side. It will be interesting to see. For one things I look at is, on the service side of things, what's going on with the work from home policy? And I mentioned that because, for example, I'm very close to Washington, D.C. And every building in Washington, D.C., your first floor is all retail and everything above it is typically office. Now, if you think about these companies now only having people go to the office 3 days a week, and typically people work from home Friday and like a Tuesday, Fridays was typically the busiest day where you did, lunchtime, let's go out for lunch.
Casual Friday. You spend an extra hour at lunch and have fun.
So you think about it, the retail, that service business is losing probably 40% of their business potentially just on because of people not going back into the office. And that affects the commercial real estate. And commercial real estate, everyone always focuses on housing, but commercial real estate can bring a lot of stuff down for construction, which is again, 4% of the GDP. So I do think we're going to start seeing some jobs, more job losses. I have no idea what percentage. I don't think it's going to be as bad in construction though, because without getting, without getting political about it in one party or the other, I don't give a shit. I'm down the middle, excuse the phrase. We do have a lack of skilled labor, which typically did come from some immigration policies, which have slowed down. And there is a lack of, you ask any contractor, and again, I don't care what your beliefs are. There is a complete lack of skilled labor today in construction, and those companies typically are busier. I think it's going to be a little bit more like 2001, where it's more white collar and tech driven, is where and I have no idea what number it will get to and so forth, but I'm not, with all of this being said, I'm not predicting like a 2008 gloom and doom and everything like that. I'm thinking more like like a 2001 where, there was pain, and stuff, but it wasn't, a mad crisis or panic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see definitely, to me, I think that the interest rate, the mortgage rate is going to go up and down. I think what we've seen in Q4, the Fed rate kind of had a limited effect on the mortgage rate. And because, they increased the Fed rate, but then it's still, the mortgage rate kept going out. So there's other dynamics going on at the same time. So I'm seeing the mortgage rate kind of probably go up, maybe go down. but I think it's going to stabilize around kind of where we are today, maybe a little bit higher. That's what I'm thinking.
It's a guess. I mean,
absolutely. You know, I mean, the economists, people that are looking at that, I mean, they don't agree about what's going on.
And, you know, and again, you got stuff going on over in, you know, Eastern Europe that can change things drastically overnight. You know, there's so much things that impact the economy today.
Yeah.
One thing I do want to jump back on real estate, where I do also think real estate, certain markets are going to get hit harder. One area that I've never been bullish on, and I think is going to be in for some pain, is certain short-term rental markets. And I'm not talking about like the beach house in Miami or the Outer Banks here on the East Coast, but you know, people buying a short-term rental 12 blocks from the ocean, and they took a line of credit to purchase that property, and that line of credit was a variable rate. So, you know, I don't know if you're, you know, on Bigger Pockets or not, which is a website.
No. Well, I am on Bigger Pockets, but I don't spend too much time there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm starting to see, you know, I go, I'm pretty frequent on there. I'm starting to see a lot of people asking for help, like, help, I bought a short-term rental.
It's
not renting. I took a line of credit out, and now, like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And I think the short-term rental market in specific areas, because it wasn't really, you know, it got overhyped quick because of the ramp up of COVID, people wanted to get out and needed a place.
Yeah.
And now that as things normalize, I think you're going to see certain areas there take a pretty good look.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was, there was like short-term rental in places that, you know, there was not really high demand in terms of tourists or in terms of business. So I mean, that's why they, you know, you see on YouTube and stuff like that, and TikTok and Instagram, like, they call it Airbnb bust. So they're really under a challenging time right now.
Well, and the other thing too is Airbnb used to, I believe at one point in time was, and I forget the name of what they call these companies, but like a Peloton, where they could not even afford their debt service. So they're just continually based off of raising money. And now that VC money has started to dry up because rates have gone up and VCs aren't invested, Airbnb now has to increase their rates. You know, it's like Uber. You know, people don't realize Uber is going to get a lot more expensive. Uber wasn't making any money. And now Uber needs to make money because VC money's dried up. So essentially, Uber was paying you to drive in their cars. Now Uber is also like, we got to make money. So what's going to happen? Uber rates are going to go up. So what are people going to do? Well, I'm just going to call a cab company, go back to using the cab. Wow. Airbnb, the same thing is, wait a second, I'm going to have to go spend, I'm going to have to pay more now to spend at this place where I still got to do my own dishes and clean the place. I'm just going to go to a hotel, you know? So, you know, you'll start to see, you know, go back to some of that in some locations.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of short-term rental, to be honest. I like the hotels, I like the services and stuff like that, and the convenience and the location where they are. I know exactly what to expect. You know, like these Airbnbs, I mean, sometimes they're great space, good price, good location, but sometimes like 50% of the time, it's kind of like a crapshoot. And, you know, so I'm not a big fan of the Airbnb space. But. So anyway, Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you. So tell us about kind of like where people can reach you about the about your fund. And I think you have a YouTube channel also. Maybe you can tell us about that so people can follow you.
Yeah. So to see our fund, you can go to 7einvestments.com. And it's actually the number 7, then the letter E, then the word investments.com. And we also, YouTube, look up 7E Investments as well. We also have a podcast called Creating Wealth Simplified, where we talk about a lot of things like you talk about, creating, generating, passing wealth, and also entrepreneurs who kind of created side hustles as well, or businesses to continue, to grow. So those are the two main avenues. And if people did want to email me, it's, Chris at the number 7 letter E investments.com. So yeah, you can, you know, also Google me, because there's only one other Chris 70, so you'll find one of us.
Great. Well, thank you, Chris, really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Eric, for having me, and enjoy your weekend.
And of course, I'm going to have all these links in the show notes. Thank you. And see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Break Away from the Rat Race with your host, Eric Martel. If you want to share your story and experience with our listeners, please message us on Facebook at Break Away from the Rat Race. Also, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and our podcast on iTunes.